It's time for She Says Art and He Says Science, your weekly hour of edutainment as you learn about the creative interaction between artists and scientists. With your host, Jill Dittmeyer, curious journalist and arts enthusiast, and Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit. Now it's time for She Says Art and He Says Science.
Hello, I'm Jill Dittmeyer, curious journalist and arts enthusiast.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and community can create unique interactions and conversations.
And we are having a very unique conversation today. We are recording our interview today via Zoom so we can see and hear our guests, but you at home are just going to be able to hear them. But we have a great topic today. We're talking about the art and science of edible insects. Yes, we are talking about that. They pack a powerful protein punch, I would say, Mark, and we'll get this conversation started.
Please welcome Andrea Baisiega, and she's the director of the Sensory Evaluation Lab in the Food Science Department at Purdue University. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, how are you, Mark, Jill,
good.
Joseph?
Hello.
So good to have you. And we have Chef Joseph Yoon, who's the owner and creator of Brooklyn Bugs, edible insect advocates. Hello, Joseph.
Greetings, everyone. Nice to see everyone again.
Nice to have you guys with us.
Thank you.
Bugs.
So, Andrea, you are in a sensory evaluation lab. What is that?
It's actually a fun place where we ask people to come over and taste food and beverages and then tell us what they think about them, about the appearance, the aroma, the flavor, the texture, mouthfeel, and then they get a reward afterwards. So on top of trying a delicious, tasty food, they also get a reward when they're done the task.
That's really great. And so I would assume, what besides the science of understanding taste and that, what are you also trying to understand from that?
So what we're trying to do is use a controlled atmosphere or ambient for them to limit the bias that sometimes will hinder the way we are perceiving food. And we try to evaluate in a more analytical way how the human body is perceiving the appearance, the flavor, the aroma, the taste, mouthfeel of the food without the constraints of the psychological bias that typically surround us. So in order to for us to say, okay, this food has this particular flavor or taste or aroma, we want to make sure that's because, in fact, the human body is perceiving it that way and not because someone next door to us is telling us that's what it smells like or tastes like, but because we're actually perceiving it with our senses.
Wow. So it's outside of its normal packaging, its environment, so that they look at it. I would assume they don't. Do they see color?
They can see color if that's something we're interested in within the appearance, but sometimes we want them to focus only on the flavor or the aroma, then we have to mask the color. So we have specific lights that we use in the lab that make the room very dark, and we use red lighting that will mask any appearance differences between the samples.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, it's fun.
Joseph, bugs in a restaurant. That's usually a really taboo thing, having bugs in a restaurant.
Yes, indeed. So I think that one of the most important things to distinguish is bugs that are undesirable, things that are a pest, things that you don't want. And to be able to change the perception completely differently so that people begin to understand edible insects and distinguish them as something that's sustainably farmed or harvested specifically for human consumption, and something that I get from my vendors that are all from FDA-approved facilities. And so that is where a big mystery lies, is how do we get people that consider insects generally as the undesirable, disgusting, I don't want bug bites or I don't want them in my house, and get them to start thinking about it in different terms where we're not just asking them to accept it, we're asking them to accept it as a food source.
Wow, so culinary bugs.
Indeed.
Versus pests. I mean, I guess that would be the best way to describe it.
So a really huge part of this is that it requires on the ground level a complete reinvention, and almost like we need new words, we need new terms, we need a new like facelift. And so what Andrea is doing at the Sensory Evaluation Lab, her work is so critical just even to help people understand what does a cricket taste like. And everyone's default is like, oh, it tastes nutty, duh, nutty, nutty. And it's like, well, how many nuts are there? Hundreds? And how vastly different do those nuts taste even? And so for us to start working with scientists and with universities, that will help people to understand just how to start accepting it, I think is like incredibly important. And that's why Andrea, I playfully and respectfully call her my IC, my intellectual crush, because I have such great respect for the work that she does. And for her to show her interest in edible insects and for us to meet with the gastronomical arts and the science, I think has been incredibly just like a really rewarding and incredible experience for me.
And Andrea, during the time that you've been doing this, have you noticed that more people are wanting to learn more about it and become involved in that whole sensory evaluation process?
Yes. Actually, you know, when I started working with edible insects here at Purdue, maybe like back in 2014, 2015, really, like, it was very taboo. And even to get permission to do the sensory evaluation with human subjects, we had to really express and explain to the ethical board at the university that, no, these are, you know, farmed insects that are eaten all over across the world by many countries, you know, including as far as close as in Mexico. You can go to a five-star high-quality restaurant or in the street vendors and eat insects. I mean, it's not something that it's out of the ordinary in many countries. So back then, it was a little bit of a challenge to get the permission to do the sensory evaluation with insects because of the taboo associated with them, as Joseph had explained, associating them with pests and other not so very kind words related to bugs. But now, like as the years have gone by, we've seen a change in the acceptance and the willingness of the average consumer to actually try insects, and not just for fun, not just as a fear factor episode, but more as a, okay, let me try something new. This is a new protein source. This may help alleviate world hunger towards the year 2050. So there's other interest now with new generations of wanting to try insects. Yes, it has changed.
And Joseph, you work with a lot of young people. Do you think that they automatically are willing to try things like insects, and especially because they're so environmentally conscious, maybe much more so than people of older ages?
It's been really fascinating to see who has been attracted and drawn to edible insects. And while I think that you have one segment of the sort of adventurous eaters, I think that segment of the population, while wonderful, is not the only group that will help us to successfully adopt insect protein in America. And so to even win over, you know, gain the interest. I mean, Andrea was working on this before I was, of scientists is vital. And the students, I've had a very mixed reaction. However, I would say that younger people are generally more likely to try edible insects because they're like, oh, why not? And it's sustainable. And as many of you guys know, I often present 8-12 dishes at all the events that I do, the public events that I do. And so I don't want someone to say, ew, I don't want to see the insect. And so it's like, fine, we have this beautiful cricket gougère, this cheese puff, or a mealworm brownie. So we try to present them in as many ways as possible. Or, oh, I'm gluten-free. Then it's like, fine, we'll present as many different options and try to exhaust every single possible out that someone will have. Like, I don't eat meat. This is a vegetarian dish with insects. And so it's been really interesting to see, because we work with children's groups that are in grade school and preschool, and also with college students. And it's really been incredible just to see which one of these students are going to say yes, and which one are going to be kind of have that visceral disgust. And then the great turnaround is seeing some of these kids that show a great disdain, and they're kind of, I could tell they're really kind of grossed out by the idea. But then they see their friends eating it, and then they go, oh, okay. Oh, so Andrea, Mark's eating it, Jill's eating it. Maybe I'll try it. And so it's really wonderful just to see how easily people are willing to accept it when given the actual opportunity, where it's not a theoretical thing or hypothetical, but they actually have 10 different dishes in front of them and they see their friends also eating it as well.
So Joseph, what you're doing is sometimes the insect is the star, just like the other protein source might be a star, but other times you're doing exactly what we do with any other protein source. Sometimes it's just part of a dish is
yeah.
what you're saying. And so, you know, I don't think any of us like looking at raw chicken very much, or,
yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? I mean, if you think yeah. about other protein sources, even including some of our vegetable protein sources, they're kind of uglier and not, you know, they're kind of put offish. Andrea, though, I had this question that was coming up between you and Joseph, and this is interesting. Are we really inhibited by our language to describe? Because when he was talking about different nuts, that tastes like nuts, do you find in the food lab, and Joseph, do you find that we're really limited in being able to say it tastes like or describe something?
I think at first we are. Like one of the labs I run with the students when I teach them sensory science as part of their undergrad curriculum in food science, I make them describe olive oil. So I buy 4 or 5 different brands of olive oil, different types, you know, quality, and I make them describe each one of them, and they don't know which one, like they're coded with numbers, so they don't even know what they're trying, they just know it's olive oil. And they, at first, they're like, well, it smells like olive oil. And I'm like, yeah, but what else? Like, close your eyes, tell me more, you know, think about it, you know, what does it bring you back to, what memories? And they start opening up, and it's like when you describe wine, you know, they just start flowing with words and terms that I can't even keep up my writing down all the terms they're describing. So I think it's something we just need to get trained in or accustomed to really, when we're eating food and tasting it, to really, you know, savoring it and seeing what we're perceiving and going beyond of the first impression.
I think if we learned those tools too, it would help all of us, one, to appreciate food a lot more. Mm-hmm. It creates a better all around experience. And honestly, if people are, you know, people are always worried about their weight and eating too much, sometimes people just eat without tasting anything. Mm-hmm. And to be able to re-engage ourselves with the aromas and the flavors of food obviously is great benefit for you in the sensory lab, but it's really just a good thing for people in general. And especially as a chef, Jeff Joseph, I'm sure you probably think the same way.
Yeah, Jill, you actually bring up a really important point. And I think that I have some examples that I give, and one might be with, like, I'll go with garlic, because I love garlic so much, and I've posted recently a lot about garlic. And you think about the first time someone may have introduced you to garlic, and they're like, here, try garlic. It's so delicious. I eat it with everything. And you like, okay, and you take a bite of raw garlic, you're like, this is absolutely putrid. Like, vampires don't like this for a reason.
Sulfur central, yeah.
And then someone's like, oh, sorry, you're supposed to cook it, fry it or roast it, and bring out the natural sugars in it. And it's supposed to be add to the flavor profile of the dish and be an aromatic. And you start learning how to work with garlic. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, I love garlic. And so I think it's similar.
Bam.
Yeah. And so I think it's a similar thing with all these edible insects, is that a lot of people are still just chomping into an entire bulb of raw garlic, not even just like one clove, because they're like, oh, crickets, let me try some. And another point that that leads to is that sometimes people might have a bad experience with insects, maybe the chef or whoever prepared it, or maybe they got it at a museum gift shop and it's been just sitting around in a box and it has no flavor. And it's like, I'm sure you've been to a diner where you ate your favorite burger or omelet and it wasn't that good. Do you write it off forever? Or do you maybe try it again because you know you love it? And so I just really try to encourage people to give an opportunity and try to like cook with it, try to understand edible insects and the extreme, like just like broad applications that you can have. And so for me, I mean, that's why I put up 5-7 new dishes every day, every week on social media, working with insect protein. And a lot of it could be comfort food. Some of it incorporates the cricket hydrolysates that I received from Andrea's grad student, Gabby. And it's just really incredible, because what that allows me to do as a chef is, okay, let me see how I can successfully incorporate 30 grams of cricket protein without it being so overtly, cloyingly cricket, but just so that it blends into the dish in a vegetarian dish with 30 grams of this protein. And Andrea, maybe you can explain a little bit about the process of hydrolysates and what cricket hydrolysates are.
Yeah, sure. It's actually very straightforward. We just grind up crickets and we add water and we create like a very thick milkshake full of cricket parts. But to that, we actually incorporate commercial enzymes that break down the protein into smaller fragments that have enhanced, develop new flavors and new attributes that make this protein more easily to be incorporated into food products, like when Joseph uses it during his culinary dishes, or when we in the food industry, we would use this enhanced protein powders to formulate food products with them. So it's in a nutshell, that's what we do. Obviously, it takes a little bit more work and effort in the lab, but that's basically how they produce a lot of the protein powders that we have in the market today, from dairy or soy, other sources as well.
So I thought that was interesting, Andrea. You had you're enhancing what would be there. In other words, you're allowing the natural flavors, the taste, to come, but to come forward more through that process. Is that correct?
Yes. When you break the protein down, like when you unfold the protein, because we're heating it and then we're adding this enzyme that comes and like scissors cuts the protein into different fragments, those fragments of protein, which we call peptides, are unique. They will have unique characteristics in aromas, in flavor, but also in how they will function in a food with other components in the food, whether it's fat, carbohydrates, fiber, with water. So they would behave differently depending on their size and the type of amino acids that are on each end of that chain, of that fragment. So it's really interesting because you can do so many things with them and there's so many combinations you can try to develop different products.
Do certain bugs break down better than others?
I think, because we're using these commercial enzymes, which are food grade enzymes commonly used in the food industry, they're really good. They will break down anything. So with crickets, you know, they have that hard exoskeleton that's full of chitin. But the enzyme we use in particular, alkalase, it's called alkalase, it will just go in there and break it down. Like it will liquefy it within 30, 40 minutes. It's pretty good.
Well, so that's really part of the magic of food science that Andrea provides, is that I can replicate creating the hydrolysates in my kitchen or in like a regular kitchen. I mean, they use a centrifuge and it goes through the whole process. But what she mentioned about the hydrolysate, the hydrolyzation removes the chitin and removes a lot of the fats. And so you have something that is more water soluble and that is allows me as a chef to work with something that's more soluble and able to be manipulated in food production. And so when we start introducing things for, ideally for the masses, when we start, you know, trying to conceive of new products, when we have this capability and this function with negligible flavor as well, without a really intense nutty flavor, the hydrolyzation really gives a mild flavor on the crickets, much more so than the roasted crickets, which is really what brings a nutty flavor.
Yeah, so that makes me think of a couple questions related. One is, do different species taste differently, smell differently? And second, within a species, like within crickets, there's many different crickets, do they also vary?
Yes, they do. And I mean, I've tried a lot of just plain insects, like without being incorporated into food, and they're all unique in their taste, in their aromas, and in their mouthfeel. And Joseph too, I mean, he's had, I don't know how many species, but we keep a list, right?
Yeah.
Of how many we've tried. And I mean, I can tell, maybe Joseph, you can share some of the best ones you've had. I know for me, my favorite one is the bamboo.
The bamboo worm
is delicious. I had it in Thailand with some basil, and it was sort of stir fried. And it was just, the flavor was amazing. I just ate the whole bag by myself. So yes, I don't know, Joseph, which one is your favorite one?
Yeah, well, you know, it's really fascinating because I don't want to put you on the spot, Andrea, but I believe we applied for a USDA grant. I'm not sure what the status is of it.
Oh, yeah, not good news.
Okay. But
we thought it was a great idea, but the reviewers didn't think so. They're still not very keen on insects. So I don't know what's happening with this planet, but.
Well, going back.
Maybe they'll hear this show and they'll change their mind.
That's right. Next time.
but you know, the idea though that, okay, what does a cricket taste like? What do the different species taste like? I mean, what me and Andrea wanted to do, I mean, one of the things that we want to do is like, okay, how does, the cricket has a very small gastrointestinal tract. How does the feed affect what it's going to taste like, right? And so even starting from there, and then it's like, okay, so how does freeze drying, using hydrolysates, or roasting them, how does that affect the flavor profile? Purging them, how long do you purge them for? You know, there are so many factors, and we really wanted to empirically, categorically, like systematically, scientifically, I mean, really, I guess that's really what it comes down to, have those answers. And I think that is so important for us because, I mean, here's another food example. I talked about cherries recently, and people like, I'm like, so what's it taste like? People are like, sweet, tart. Those are two completely opposite tastes, right? And the same goes for like strawberries. Some people could say sweet, some people say, you know, and so it's like trying to define what food tastes like is so vital to our understanding, just like with art. You look at Picasso's art, maybe you've never been exposed to modern art or cubism, and you're like, what is that? That's not art. That looks like a child can draw that. And then you start learning about the process, and you're like, oh my God, my mind is blown with the artistry involved. And so a big part of what I feel like I'm trying to do is not just present this in a gastronomical fashion, nor intellectual, because that's what I feel like Andrea and a lot of the scientists are doing, but also cultural integration is going to be extremely key so that we can have more intersection points and like points where people will be able to go, oh yeah, I saw that artwork, Jennifer Angus's incredible art where she utilizes insects as the main medium. And while that doesn't focus primarily on edible insects, it's like the onus then is on me or us to be able to control the narrative and say like, oh, wow, her focus is on sustainability and really focusing on conservation, like I am with edible insects. And so it's like really trying to find and create the narrative where we can have multiple points of engagement and interest for people to gain just like the curiosity and want to learn more. And that's why I feel like the education and outreach is like paramount for people to like be open to the idea of even trying insects for the first time.
Right. And but refining the taste and the flavors too also benefits, because different cultures like different types of food. Some cultures like sweeter foods, some like saltier foods. So then it also gives you a better opportunity to address that community with a certain, you know, maybe these three crickets are going to be more palatable to that community as opposed to these three. And that's just going to make it easier for them to accept it into their society.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's why I think there's no silver bullet or one bug or one dish. Like, what do you think it's going to take? It's not like one thing. In order for 320, 50 million, I mean, we'll see what the census reports in America, however many people there are in America, to accept this as a viable food source to start seeing in grocery stores and everything. It is a movement that requires everybody to get involved. And so that's why for me, it's like I try to really instill a sense of inclusiveness, be very welcoming. When people have a very negative response, I try to take it in stride and not be defensive about it. Listen to the way they do. And if they give me an opportunity to a little bit about why they might want to consider it, then I feel like that's a really wonderful opportunity to engage in conversation and really discuss these ideas for how to make insect protein approachable for someone that may not be interested.
Yeah, and you, exactly. I think what you're trying to do is call it out to not being so special. In other words, it's like any other part of what we would use in a cuisine. So if I go to a really nice restaurant, sometimes they have a description and I read maybe what it sort of is, but I have no really clue what it's going to taste like because that chef is going to do something with it. And I like that, and a lot of people like just being able to discover, right? And so I think you're right. I think moving it beyond the cultural kind of idea that, ooh, to just it's there and it's a part of the food. It's a part of the taste. It's part of the overall flavor. Andrea, do you think that when we get kind of back to where we allow more immigration in our country and more diversity, that people coming from other cultures who really have insect as a part of their cuisine and their culture, that may begin to change some of what we see in the United States in terms of people's taboo about it?
Yeah, that will definitely play a role. But you know what's optimistic about it, about eating insects, is that even now, like, you know, from, like I said, tracing it a few years back and where we are today, there is an increased interest by the people in the U.S. to actually try insects. We had, remember, Joseph, last year at the Bug Bowl and the Spring Fest at Purdue. In food science, Joseph made amazing dishes for two full days, and we had over 3,000 people come to 3,000 people come to the food science department to sample all the culinary delicacies that Chef Joseph Yoon prepared, and it was amazing. And you know, these are people that are from the U.S., not necessarily that immigrated, or maybe they did, I don't know. But you know, they were very willing to try all these dishes. So I think it's just because now we're more aware with internet and social media, we're more aware of what other countries are doing. Like, all of us are aware of what's going on around the world, and I think that's influencing this culture, multiculturalism around the world as well.
I'd like to add, Andrea, that it was not me, but your grad students. It was really just
team effort.
Such an incredibly beautiful experience to be invited to Purdue and to work with the Food Science Lab, which I would consider is widely considered as like one of the best in the world globally, and for them to you know, invite me to come during Spring Fest, where all these students come and parents come and they open all the buildings up. And the food science can be a little overlooked because of all the astronauts and the science and math departments, but it was just really incredible to participate and to gain the interest of you guys and be on NPR during the visit and be written about in the regional newspapers and have the local news channels come and highlight the work that we're doing and not necessarily for the math and science. I mean, we are part of the science, but in the ag department. And for us to gain that kind of interest, it shows that people are interested. There is a great deal of interest, but there's also a great deal of fear. Just the unknown, like, what is this? Like, isn't that for poor people, or isn't that like a desperate last resort? And each of these sort of opportunities that we have to share this work, I feel like peels a layer of the onion where it allows people to hear it more. And the more you know about something, the more likely you are to not be so, to have such a reaction, like a, you know, just like the initial reaction. Mm-hmm. And in one of the presentations that I have, this like electricity cartoon from the early 1900s, late 1800s. And it shows like a skull with electricity demonstrating like electricity is death, it's evil. Because there was a time when people thought that. But look at where we are now. Where would we be without electricity? There's a time where people thought the earth was flat and they were being killed if they said otherwise, that it was round. It's like, well, you die. You believe in something totally absurd. And so I just think that like it takes a little bit of time. And while some people project it'll take 20, 30 years, like it took sushi or, you know, various new foods to take hold, I really think based on the trajectory, the exponential rise of interest, just the growth of the industry, the dialogue, all the media that's generated around the idea of edible insects, I really do think that it's going to occur far sooner. And I mean, I really think it's 5-10 years. And I've been saying that for like 2 years now. So I guess I should say 6 to 8 years.
Less time than that. Well, we're doing our part today, and we're speaking with that Chef Joseph Yoon. He is with the Brooklyn Bugs, and Andrea Lisiaga. She's with the Purdue Food Science Department. Yep, we're talking about edible insects. We're going to take a break, but first we want to remind you that today's program is made possible by the generosity of an anonymous donor who supports the Da Vinci Pursuit's mission of creating a museum without walls so that artists, scientists, and you, the community, can all come together for unique activities and definitely unique conversations. We're going to continue ours in just a minute. We'll be right back.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor. Tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
Welcome back. We have two really wonderful guests, Andrea Lisiaga of the Food Evaluation Lab and Food Science Department at Purdue, Chef Joseph Yoon, who's the owner and creator of Brooklyn Bugs. And we are actually talking about eating bugs, consuming bugs, and bug protein. But I've heard some very alarming reports lately that have come out in some major science journals about that there may be underway some very serious threat to the existence of some insects. In fact, there may be some major extinctions of insects along the way. And does that concern you, Andrea?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me in the show again. And I'm very happy to be here. But I think my main concern is it's not only insects. I think we are the human race is actually sending every other species in this planet to extinction except us. And if anything this pandemic has taught us is that we are the worst species in this planet, and we should learn from what has happened and start respecting the planet more. And we're not the only ones that deserve to live here. It's not just the insects, it's all the other species as well. But insects, I mean, the amount of use of pesticides that we use, the changes in the climate that we are causing because of our actions, all of that are being detrimental to insect populations among all the other animals and plants, all the biodiversity in our planet, unfortunately. So it's not just the insects, but it's definitely because of our actions. The thing with edible insects is that at least in, obviously in countries where they have consumed insects culturally for hundreds, if not thousands of years, they're wild caught. But in the case of Western countries and what we're, like I know with Chef Yoon and myself and all the scientists that are trying to work with promoting insect protein, we're actually promoting the farming of insects. So that way you're actually not creating an imbalanced ecosystem by harvesting insects from the wild, but actually farming them sustainably by not using a lot of water, not using a lot of land, not using a lot of feed, and getting enough protein from these insects without having to have an impact in the wild populations.
I think that that's so key, that idea of farming. You know, the same thing with fish. Fish are not going to be sustainable into the future wild caught. We do have to improve some of the safety with some of that, you know, in the way we farm raise. But you are absolutely right. My big worry about, and you were talking about that a little bit, but we know a lot of the other species. We've identified many of them. Birds, we're pretty good at knowing. All mammals, would probably have seen most mammals. Every once in a while, we find something every 10 years or something. Mm-hmm. But in the insect world, we have really no clue as to the diversity of species, because these guys, particularly in rainforest areas, they live high in the canopy, where it's very hard to do research, very hard to find, you know, what's there. And so when things like the rainforest destruction or habitat destruction, you're right, Andrea, we lose the knowledge of even what we didn't even know existed.
And even at home, I mean, how many of us, I know I have stopped since I started working with insects. I used to have a yearly subscription for pest control, and they would come and spray the house twice a year. And then, you know, a few years ago, I said, enough, what am I doing? Why am I killing them? Let them come into my house. I don't answer that. No problem. You know, I'll find a way of getting rid of them without having to actually kill them with chemicals, send them away somewhere else. But is this obsession we have as humans of, you know, no bugs and pesticides and kill everything that bothers us instead of trying to live with all the other species that are surrounding us and respecting them?
About it too, like you said, the domino effect of that, of the pesticides, you know, we don't know what all it's hurting. I also think about in the pandemic situation, you know, there have been strains on the food supply and the food chain. Mm-hmm. And why not have another potential source that, you know, farm-raised crickets is a great source of protein. It can be delivered and it can be, you know, served up very tasty too. It's another... it makes a lot of sense.
Yes. And actually, when all this pandemic thing happened, it was just as they were showing in the news about the food scarcity, especially with the primary protein sources like beef, poultry, pork. That was at the same time that our USDA proposal, the Nugget, funded. So I was like, that's kind of ironic. You know, here I am receiving this news that what we're proposing about using farmed crickets for human food, it's not worth the funding. Yet we're having food scarcity and problems with beef production and pork and poultry. So it's a little bit disappointing as a scientist to have this daily struggles.
You know, I think that you guys are bringing up a few really great points. That one, indeed, insects are nutrient dense. They're also shelf stable. And when we're going through all these issues with livestock production at scale and the prices are soaring, it's like, why don't we, isn't this like just a perfect time to start exploring the idea of insect protein? And not only that, but, you know, going back to Mark's original question about the alarming disappearance of insects, some people have, I would say debated, but I would maybe even go as far as to say argued with me about, you're eating bugs and they're disappearing. I'm like, that has nothing to do with one another. We're talking about farming these insects, one, and the value of finding a sustainable source of protein is really tremendous. It's sacred. And not only that, but you take a look at the importance that we place on the disappearance of like bees, the pollinators, or the value that we might put in silkworms because they provide silk. And we think about the value that humans put on a commodity when they have a greater value than just the form. Like think about the value we put in cows, for example, in cattle or whatever it is. So when we start defining edible insects as a nutritious, sustainable, delicious food source, we're going to start caring more. And so what I argue is that the idea of conservation for insects and the importance of their livelihood in our ecosystems cannot be more emphasized. And the work that we're doing with edible insects, I think, will only help to raise that awareness, not only for edible insects, but also for insects as a whole.
Joseph, I think that's a really key point, because I think sometimes, and Andrea, you said it with funding, sometimes public opinion helps drive where we can have the money and resources to do research. And if we can go down the path you're talking about, Joseph, I think then it becomes important as a food source, which means just like any other things, corn, anything else that we'll find more money and dollars for research as we go down that path. The other is that people will embrace it as being part of them, not a pest, not something to get rid of, and understand that. I know the scariest thing that I always see is just what you were, Andrea, is not somebody's yard being treated with a pesticide, because they're broad spectrum. They kill everything. And I try to tell them, you just killed your soil. I mean, you killed all living stuff.
Yes.
Except your green grass. And now you're going to pay to have it green.
Yeah.
Because it won't stay green because your soil's so bad now. And you cannot get anybody, because industry of the pesticide industry is huge business.
Yes.
And it's very difficult.
It's because now we've been made to believe that we have to have the perfect green lawn. I'm like, why? Mine can be yellow. I'm not watering more than once a week. And if it doesn't rain and it dies, I don't care. It's like
wildflowers are so much better for the pollinators, and having like the weeds grow instead of like just like a green lawn. I mean, that's like so inefficient.
And one important thing that I did want to bring up again before we forget or move on is that also the resources that are needed to farm, to produce 1 kilogram of protein from crickets or insects in general, the amount of water, like I said, feed, land, like square footage of land needed, compared to the other traditional protein sources like your beef, pork. Poultry is very similar. Poultry is pretty sustainable in that aspect as well. But I mean, when you compare it to beef or pork, you know, it's amazing. Like, I don't understand why we're not putting more effort into this type of resources when it's right there, like slapping us in the face of farm insects, like for food. It's worth it.
And that science part of that, with it being in on the food chain, it's the closest to the plant, which is the supply we have of all those animals. In other words, it's the it takes the least amount of energy for it to grow. Everything else has to eat something else, you know, and the cow has to eat a lot of something else. And so this is one of those where, you know, they're very efficient. Insects are very efficient at turning that food source that they have from the sun into the sugars and proteins that we need.
Yes, and I mean, they just eat plants and grains and produce amazing, good quality protein. Sorry, Jill, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No. What you're saying is exactly right, and now is the best time to take this to that next step. The conversations that Mark and I have been having since we've been Zoom calling during the pandemic, everyone is having to rethink how they're running their business and how it's going to be in the future, and everyone needs to consider that we're not through pandemics. This is going to happen again. It's going to continue. So now is the optimum time to the beauty of edible insects is you have the science and the data behind it, and you have the flavor and the ease of preparation behind it as well. The shelf stability, the cost, I think as we move forward, and I think that's the beautiful thing of the interaction between the two of you and your efforts, is that it doesn't just taste good, it makes sense, and vice versa. And I think that people, production and our leaders, our legislators, are going to have to be thinking about those kind of things a lot more long term, for keeping people healthy and fed in the years to come.
Yeah, I've been considering to revamping the shed in my backyard and just converting it into a mini cricket farm, because it has this perfect square footage, and that would be enough food to actually maybe feed the whole block in my neighborhood.
You know,
and with Chef Joseph and your outreach on Instagram and everything and online, you know, you're able to connect with people everywhere. That here's what it is, and here's how you prepare it. You know, we've all learned to, you know, technology's taken a big step up again. We're all getting really used to looking there for information, whether it's from a friend or a loved one or a recipe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and during this pandemic, Joseph, we've had an upsurge in people wanting to do culinary work in their home.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's been really interesting. First, we had the baking kind of trend, but now it's broadened out. But people still, they can't go out and eat. They want to have different tastes and flavors. So all of you as chefs and people that are writing recipes, this must be a really good time for us to really make a dent in getting people to understand.
Yeah, I really think that the time is now, and that it does present an incredible opportunity with so many people being at home to varying extents or not being out as much and looking for more content. And so one thing for me that's been tremendously rewarding and also just being given an opportunity to speak with you guys, for example, and being given a platform in so many different areas, it's just invaluable, because without the outreach, without the education, how will people know or about the values? And it's not just on Andrea or for me or for the other scientists that we work with to extol the virtues and values of the sustainability and deliciousness, but it really does require an entire community effort led by really the students, college students. And that's why being given an opportunity to work with Andrea's college students and grad students, I mean, I am actively trying to recruit students to join this fledgling industry. I mean, Barclays, they recently put out a report of meticulous research that the industry last year was $796 million, and they projected to blossom, explode to $8 billion within 10 years. And so where does all that come from? And so it's not only good for the livelihood and nutrition, but also really it is going to provide jobs. Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's something that as we continue to progress in this world, and I was at a conference and they said something really interesting that something like 60 or 80%, I'm forgetting the exact stat now, and I know that's a big variance, but 60% of the jobs in 10 years don't even exist right now. And so where will all these new jobs come from in the technological fields? And there are all these different areas where this potential will come from. And I just feel like the more people know about this industry, the viability of it, the creativity. If you're an English major, wow, we need help with coming up with new words in the copy for how to deal with this. If you're a business major, if you're an engineer, help us create the farming gear for us to scale this and be able to grow metric tons of this. You know, we need every single field of technology and the academics, and so that's part of the great things about being able to share this mission with college students.
Yeah, that was actually, I was teaching this spring semester before we went into the pandemic, the capstone product development class for our graduating seniors in food science. And one of their, sort of their mission for their course this year, I said, you know, you have to develop, you are graduating as food scientists, you're going to be the future leaders in the food industry. I need to know about your ethics in producing a sustainable, you know, having a sustainable food supply for the generations to come. What are we feeding the people that are, you know, our people? And it's in your hands. So it's a big responsibility. So you as food scientists, I need to know that you're going to be using sustainable resources, that you're going to branch out of the conventional, traditional sources. And they had to develop products using emerging or alternative protein sources. So they started using pea protein, some were maybe looking into using insects, others were using like invasive fish species. So each one of them started like spent grain, brewer's grains and whatnot. So they were all trying to develop projects using alternative protein sources because we have to start looking into the future and the people that were, the professionals that were preparing in academia, you know, or in like in food science, engineering, what have you, in agriculture in general, they have to be aware that the world is changing and there's new challenges coming, and we need to have these generations ready to go and tackle this new tasks in the world.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I loved being given the opportunity to hear your grad students give a presentation. That was really a highlight, and see how innovative they can be with like pea protein and like just like with like different fishes and how do we taste it? And, you know, it really is, there's no limitation really with edible insects. And I feel like with like gaining the interest of college students and grad students, I mean, they're really the ones that I feel like we need the most help from right now, is because they're like the smart, like kids coming up with new ideas and everything. And so that was really particularly a very special afternoon for me to do that. I was so happy about that.
Well, and they are right. All of them are caught up in the midst of this pandemic too. I mean, they're learning what it's like to live at home and to live without a lot of things. So now is more than ever to think ahead, to think forward. How can we simplify, but yet still plentify everyone with what they need when it comes to food and that sort of thing? We've only got a couple of minutes left here. So Joseph, we have to ask you for a couple of recipes, you know, give us a couple of,
oh yeah.
What can we do? Where can we find the product and what can we do with it?
Well, I like to think of edible insects as a wonderful ingredient that you can incorporate literally into any of your favorite dishes. So instead of starting with something like a crazy idea, I just think of your comfort food. Is it mac and cheese? Is it fried rice? And incorporate cricket powder into it, or stir fry the crickets. I really think that the importance of this is really demonstrating it is part of our regular food, and it's just an ingredient that you can utilize. Like, and the fascinating thing is like with various cricket powders, and especially with the hydrolysates that Andrea, that they make at Purdue, the taste can, I would go on a blind taste test with people, and I would say I can successfully hide the crickets or whatever insect into the food without people knowing. I mean, it can be flavor forward, but it can be very hidden. And just today, actually, the Audubon Society, they posted my mealworm brownie recipe. So you could see that video on the Audubon Society.
There we go. Yeah. Well, you've enticed us for certain, Chef Joseph, and we really want to thank you, that Chef Joseph Yunus, the creator of Brooklyn Bugs and the Edible Insects Advocates, and Andrea Lisiago, the director of the Sensory Evaluation Lab in the Food Science Department at Purdue University. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Pleasure to be here. What an honor. Thank you.
And you'll find pictures of their projects and hopefully some recipes and other things from other guests on our website, thedaVinciPursuit.com, where we create museums without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can come together to enjoy unique activities and conversations.
So next time, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to stay curious.
Thank you for listening to She Says Art and He Says Science. You can listen to the full show podcast on WICRonline.org, as well as on thedaVinciPursuit.com. Or you can join your hosts, Jill Dittmeyer and Mark Kiesling, here every Saturday at 1 p.m. on a different kind of public radio, 88.7 WICR.